This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
On behalf of the Muslim Students Awareness Network and the Islamic Society of Stanford University, I'd like to welcome you all to the third part of our annual Islamic Awareness Series, entitled this year, Our Jihad to Reform, the Struggle to Define Our Faith. First of all, we'd like to acknowledge and thank our co-sponsors, the Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education, Dr. John Brockman, the Stanford Law School, the Abbasi Program in Islamic Studies, the Department of Religious Studies, the Office of Religious Life, the Freeman's Ogley Institute, the Billy Achilles Fund, and the Bechtel International Center. Without their support, we would not have been able to bring such amazing speakers to campus here. The title of today's talk is Laying Down the Sharia Law, Democracy or Theocracy? Dr. Sherman Jackson, Professor of Islamic Studies at the University of Michigan, will discuss whether Sharia, the Islamic legal system and code of conduct and religious practice, is compatible at all with values such as pluralism, democracy, secularism, and human rights. Too often, we have had this conception that all that is needed is to open the source text of Islam and full-fledged, fully developed economic, social, and political system pop out, ready to be implemented as Sharia law. Furthermore, the idea of the Sharia as a system in which the state has exclusive authority over the creation of a uniform legal code was not present in pre-modern Muslim societies. And it is here that the Islamic legal tradition that originated in those societies can offer insights on issues such as the relationship between the religious and political orders in the formation of public policy. In order for Muslim societies to define a democratic and pluralistic form of government that at the same time is representative of their historical and social realities. Before we get started, I have the great honor of introducing our speaker today. Professor Sherman Jackson received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in Oriental Studies, Islamic Near East, in 1919. Presently, he is Professor of Arabic and Islamic Studies, Visiting Professor of Law, and Professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Michigan. From 1987 to 89, he served as executive director for the Center of Arabic Studies abroad in Cairo, Egypt. Professor Jackson has taught at the University of Texas at Austin, Indiana University, and Wayne State University. In addition to numerous articles on Islamic law, theology, and history, he is the author of the following books: Islamic Law and the State, The Constitutional Jurisprudence of Shahabuddin al-Qarafi, On the Boundaries of Theological Tolerance in Islam, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali's Faisal al-Tafrika, and most recently, Islam and the Black American, Looking Towards the Third Resurrection. Professor Jackson is co-founder of the American Learning Institute for Muslims, ALIM, a primary instructor at its programs, and a member of its board of trustees. He is also a former member of the Fiqh Council of North America, past president of the Sharia Scholars Association of North America, and a past trustee of the North American Islamic Trust. He's a sought-after speaker and has lectured throughout the U.S. and in numerous countries abroad. Please join me in welcoming Professor Sherman Jackson.
Issues that are germane to the field of Islamic studies, but might not be quite So in lieu of that, what I'm going to try and do is simply talk to you in what I hope will turn out to be an intelligent and a comprehensible form about the whole enterprise of Islam, Islamic law, and particularly the context of Muslims as they negotiate their place in the American project. And in that regard, I want to make it very clear that my primary concern here will be on Islam, Islamic law, and the American state, and not the states of the Middle East or the Muslim world. And I think that obviously there'll be any number of questions about the latter once I'm done, and I'll be more than happy to try and address them to the extent that I can. All right? So let me begin by saying the following. I want to contextualize my remarks this afternoon by pointing to the following observation, and I think it's very important for us to recognize this in order to arrive at the needed degree of objectivity as we proceed to try and think both intelligently and fairly about the enterprise of Islam in the world, and more specifically in the United States. And that observation has to do with the fact that the West has, for some time now, enjoyed a certain power of definition. That is to say that it has succeeded at producing understandings of both itself and of others that the latter has felt compelled to somehow indulge or respond to. And in this sense, the West in general and the United States in particular now as the leading sort of representative of the West has found itself in a position where it has been able to play Big Brother. And by Big Brother, I'm not referring to the popular understanding of Orwell, where we generally think of the eradication of private space. But what I'm talking about is the ability to sort of incentivize others into seeing the world in a manner that confirms U.S. sensibilities and interests. The theme I have in mind is sort of the crowning gesture of the entire book, 1984, where the protagonist Winston is put into a chair and the official of the state holds up four fingers and says to Winston, "How many fingers am I holding up?" And Winston says, "Four." And the state official says, "No, I'm holding up five fingers." And then he tweaks the dial on the pain chair. And this continues all the way up to the point that Winston finally exclaims that he's trying to see five fingers. Now, the way in which this result is relevant to discussions on Islam, particularly in the West, is that Muslims feel a certain pressure to try and to prove that their religion is compatible with this or that real or ostensible Western norm. And this often has the effect of putting us in a position where we're trying to speak across sort of conflicting boundaries. When we're talking about Islam, we simply speak about Islam, but we sort of oscillate between speaking from the context of a medieval pre-modern order and a modern order. We oscillate between East and West. We oscillate between talking in terms of assimilation to the American project or participation in that. And the effect of this is almost invariably a certain amount of abstraction, whereby we end up sort of talking about an Islam that is not really real in terms of the way that it's concretized on the ground in the lives of any particular community, but it's sort of an abstraction that hovers somewhere over the Atlantic. And this makes Islam a very sort of elastic construct that can be stretched in many different directions, and out of which many, many different possibilities emerge, some of them being justifiable or defensible, others less so. Now, what I want to do is to break out of these liminal spaces and talk about Islam in the very concrete context of America. That is to say, I want to plant my feet firmly in America and speak about the whole enterprise of how Muslims and Islam can come to terms with the American project. Now, I want to say that this is not a blind capitulation to the dominant order. In fact, what's most important about this particular approach, at least in my mind, is that it assumes that Muslims are possessed of agency, that the Muslim community in America is not simply some kind of empty vessel into which this sort of pre-mixed effluvium called Islam is poured, and then it sort of quickens into this prefabricated Muslim community. On the contrary, Muslims in America are possessed of agency. And the way that Islam comes out looking will depend on the kinds of choices that Muslims in America make. And part of the importance of these kinds of exchanges is that they very fundamentally inform the kinds of discussions that will go into the kinds of choices that Muslims will make. I want to make it clear, however, as I proceed, that what Islam ultimately becomes in America will depend on time. And so there's a certain amount of there's a certain theoretical dimension to what I'm going to say, because in terms of what Islam actually comes out to be, there's a time element that cannot be ignored. Now, I'm going to proceed on the basis of four basic questions. One, the legitimacy of Muslims living in a non-Muslim democracy. Two, the legitimacy of Muslims being loyal to a non-Muslim democracy. Three, the question of Muslim solidarity with the government and the people of a non-Muslim democracy. And four, the legitimacy of Muslims sharing goals with the people and the government of a non-Muslim democracy. Now, the question of Muslim residence is, in a real sense, the leading question here. In fact, it informs all of the other questions. Because after all, if it is not legitimate for Muslims to live in a non-Muslim democracy, then of course everything else that they say about loyalty, about solidarity, etc., is sort of a makeshift holding pattern that they will stick to only as long as they feel necessary based on the level of power or the kinds of situatedness that they come into, at which time they may very well discard this particular approach. And so if we can establish the legitimacy of Muslims living in a non-Muslim democracy, then of course the kinds of answers that they proffer to questions having to do with loyalty and solidarity can be invested with a semblance of credibility. Now, we have heard, I think, many sort of warnings about the extent to which Muslims are given to the tendency to sort of tell American society at large whatever it wants to hear with regard to what Islam is and what it represents. And I think that the first thing that we need to understand about this, or to consider about this, is that most of the focus in what has been said about critics of the Muslim voice in America has been based on an analysis of immigrant communities in America. In fact, there is a running assumption to the effect that all we need to do is look at the immigrant community, and that will tell us all and everything we need to know about Islam and the possibilities of Islam. And I think that it's important to stop and note here that there is perhaps a difference between how an immigrant community of Muslims who come from other lands come to their articulations of Islam and the relationship between Islam and the American state, and how an indigenous community would do the same thing. In other words, questions of loyalty, questions of solidarity, questions of empathy will be very different for an indigenous Muslim community, that is a community that is born in this country, that emerges out of the very people of this country, that has a history in this country, and those who come to this country from another land. And the point to be made here is not to pit indigenous against immigrant communities, but to point to another range of possibilities in terms of what Islam can be in America. That is to say that people who are Muslims, who are thoroughly committed to their religion, can, on a visceral and a very natural level, come into a mindset where, as Muslims, they feel a sense of solidarity, they feel a sense of belongingness, they feel a sense of empathy with the people of the society in which they live. In fact, I'm reminded of, in this regard, of an incident that happened not long after 9/11. There was this big meeting in a church in Philadelphia. It was sponsored by Tavis Smiley. It was called the State of Black America. And this was, of course, shortly after 9/11, and there was still a lot of sort of 9/11 mania in the air. And the moderator for this particular section asked a question of the panelists on the stage, and he asked, what can we as Americans do to make Muslims feel more welcome in this country? And sort of before he could get the question out fully, the Reverend Al Sharpton stopped him and said the following, wait a minute, we want to get something straight. Because we must not lose sight of the fact that the Muslim community is already welcome among us. Because in the black community in America, there's not a person in this church, he said, who doesn't have a brother or a father or a son, a sister, a cousin, someone in their lives who are either related to them or close to them by some relationship who's not a Muslim. All right? And so the very idea that there is this essential contradiction between Muslims identifying with and having a sense of solidarity with non-Muslims in a society like America, I think that that notion must be challenged. All right? But this is not really the fundamental point I want to make here, so let me move on to that. There are some very influential people who have, in the academy, who have put forth the view that if Muslims are to be true to their religion, it is impossible for them to coexist peacefully and honestly with non-Muslims. And I want to give just one name here so that it's established. I'm not trying to, how should I put this? I'm not trying to call anyone out, as it were, but I do want to establish that I'm not making this up. And that there are actual works that have been published that you can consult and see what it is that I'm saying. And I'm talking here about Professor Patricia Cronin of Princeton University. In her latest book, she makes the claim, essentially, that, as I said, it is impossible, and by the way, for those of you who are writing things down, that book is called God's Law. She makes the claim that it is impossible for Muslims, if they are going to be sincere to their religion, to live honestly and peacefully with others. This is because jihad, according to her, is nothing less than an institution of religious imperialism, right? And that Muslims, on this understanding, must subdue their influence as a religious duty. And it is only after they have successfully fulfilled that duty that Muslims can peacefully and in good conscience live in any society. Professor Cronin goes on to make the point that this is, again, a religious duty. And in this context, non-Muslims need not be guilty of any hostility against the Muslims. In fact, and I'm quoting here, their very existence is a cause of war. End of quote. Now, she goes on to point out that the abode of Islam, abode of peace dichotomy, the Dar al-Islam, Dar al-Harb dichotomy, is a religious prescription for Muslims. That is to say that Muslims prescriptively divide the world into an abode of Islam and an abode of war. Muslims can live in abode of Islam, but the only action that is legitimate for Muslims to assume vis-a-vis an abode of war is one of hostility. Now, what I want to do, and by the way, the implication of this, of course, is that Muslims who come to live in a non-Muslim polity can only adjust to their reality by relaxing their commitment to true Islam. And this is one of the ideas that lends some credence to the idea that when Muslims speak about peace, about tolerance, about pluralism, about coexistence, this is really nothing more than a tactical maneuver. It's designed to sort of buy time, and to the point that society sort of falls asleep and wakes up one morning to find themselves in front of this grand Muslim power that is then going to show its real face. Now, and by the way, these are very serious people who are writing this. This is not popular literature, as it were. This comes from the highest echelons of the academy. Now, what I want to do is call attention to the fact that there are many aspects of the Islamic religious tradition that are the result of history and not religion. And this becomes a very difficult theme for many of us to get our minds around. And at times I wonder, you know, how much of this is indebted to the sort of enlightenment or post-enlightenment attitude that we have towards religion. In the context of which Islam becomes sort of the quintessential pre-enlightenment religion. The religion in which people sort of still believe in that stuff. Still really believe literally in the dictates of revelation. And for that reason, religion is the explanation virtually of everything that they do. Right? I don't know how, I've heard this from credible sources. Someone told me that right after a 7-7 happened in 7-7, I'm trying to be hidden. Okay. 7-7, the bombing in London, Prime Minister Tony Blair said to someone, go out and get me a copy of the Quran. Of course, this is supposed to explain why 7-7 happens. And what I'm suggesting here is that part of this may be indebted to the idea that for sort of pre-enlightenment religion is the answer for everything. So if you want to know why Muslims are doing what they do, or why they believe what they believe, you need to consult nothing more than their scriptures. Well, this idea I want to challenge, and I want to challenge a fundamental. And I want to do so through a reading of one of the most authoritative jurists, Muslim jurists, from the classical Muslim tradition. This is a man by the name of Al-Mawardi. Al-Mawardi. Al-Mawardi was a jurist of the Shafi'i school of law, and he wrote a big 14-volume opus on Islamic law. He was a major authority in the field, and his books are still held in esteem and revered with authority today. In this book, Al-Mawardi is clear that the designation abode of Islam, abode of peace, is not a religious prescription, but rather an historical description. That is to say, it is not a prescription for how Muslims should look at the world. It is a description of how Muslims found the world to be. That is to say, that Muslims basically look out at the world and discover that the only places where they can live as communities in peace are places over which they have political authority. When they find themselves as minorities in non-Muslim lands, they find it very difficult. And by the way, this is the pre-modern world now. They find it very difficult to survive as communities. Now, that is where the distinction, abode of Islam about where peace comes from. And the proof of this is that Al-Mawardi is explicit in stating that anytime a Muslim finds himself in a country where he or she is able to preserve their religion and practice the basic rudiments of their religion, even if they are not able to spread their religion by persuasion or by the sword, the mere fact that they are able to practice the rudiments of their religion renders that country an abode of Islam. Renders that country an abode of Islam. And as Mawardi goes on to say basically that if a Muslim should find his or herself in such a situation, in a non-Muslim polity, where they are able to practice the fundamental tenets of their religion, then that Muslim should not migrate from that country. And Al-Mawardi gives the implication that the reason for this is that if he's able or she's able to practice their religion, by leaving that country would be less likely then to be guided to Islam. All right? Now, we don't need to overindulge some of the sort of medieval connotations of Al-Mawardi's thought here. But the real point for us to recognize is that clearly the whole notion of an abode of Islam and an abode of peace is based on historical reality, not on religious prescription. Right? And therefore, if Muslims should find themselves in a general sense, in a position or in a historical circumstance or context wherein which it is possible for them to practice their religion, then certainly, if we apply Al-Mawardi's logic, that would render the place where they live an abode of Islam. Now, Muslims here in America have constitutional guarantees, freedom of religion. And while we may differ on our understandings or interpretation of how that is often concretized, certainly the idea of overt religious persecution is not one that sits well in the context of the American constitutional order. And here again, we run into a problem that is oftentimes confronted when thinking about Islam. When we think about Muslim communities in non-Muslim polities, the tendency is to assume the historical reality of pre-modernity, in which religious persecution would probably be the norm, rather than think about modern reality, a modern reality such as that of the United States, when that is not the case. All right? And part of what I'm trying to get us to do is to ground our understandings and our thoughts about Islam in the concrete reality of the United States. Now, in sum, there are many in the academy who would sort of locate Islam in a particular time and place and a particular mindset, and then imply from there that this mindset binds all Muslims to that particular understanding. And on that particular understanding, Muslims who live in modern polities like America can only do so if they're not really, really, really committed to Islam. But now, I want to go on and be fair here, because this is not simply a tendency that we find in Muslims. Muslims are also known to carry these kinds of ideas. And one of the major ideas in this regard that I think does a lot to impede Muslim ability to come to terms with their reality in the modern West is this idea of al-hakimiyya. It's an idea called hakimiyya. I'm going to explain that in just a second. This is a very, very well-known idea in sort of Muslim activist circles. It was popularized by the Egyptian ideologue Sayyid Qutb, and a little before him, the Pakistani Abu al-A'la al-Mawdudi. Now, basically, the idea of al-Hakimiyya says the following, that part of what the Muslim testimony of faith entails is that God and God alone is a repository of all fundamental rights and obligations. In that context, anyone who recognizes man-made rights and obligations basically challenges God's rightful monopoly over the handing down of law. In other words, to the extent that Muslims recognize man-made law and man-made polities, they are guilty of violating Islamic monotheism by attributing to someone other than God the right to make laws, to confer rights, and impose obligations. Now, Qutb and Mawdudi and those who subscribe to this notion are in a sense aided by the fact that there was an extent, the whole idea of God being the repository of ultimate value, all right, that is central to the religion of Islam. And there's no justifiable cause for attacking Qutb or Mawdudi on that score. But to move from there to the idea that any man-made law, that is to recognize any man-made law, is to be guilty of violating Islamic monotheism, that is a stretch. And I want to establish that by the following. In classical Islamic law, classical jurists always recognize a certain amount of legal discretion that was recognized to the ruler. The ruler could make laws that govern all kinds of things, from licensing medical doctors to requiring meat cutters to certify their meat, to issuing licenses for people who were going to teach in madrasas, etc. All of these things were aspects of laws and rules that Muslim rulers could hand down. And this was universally recognized as being a part of the ruler's discretion. Now, while these were man-made laws, all right, the only criterion that they had to fit was that they not in any way fundamentally violate the law of Islam. Outside of that, however, they were recognized not only as being legitimate, but perfectly necessary, because Islamic law is not a law that has every single solitary detail of what we need to regulate life. In other words, you're not going to find speed limits in the Quran. They're not there. And of course, the ruler would have to come forth and implement some kind of rule that would regulate that reality. This was a part of classical Islam, man-made to be sure, but in no way a violation of God's rightful monopoly over law. In fact, there were jurists who actually championed the idea that what we need is to promote greater discretionary powers to the ruler, not in order to undermine the law, but actually to add to the efficacy of the law. And here we're talking about not so-called sort of liberal thinkers. We're talking about jurists who are at the heart of the very Islamic legal tradition. In fact, some people whom we habitually think of today as being Puritanical. Ibn Taymiyyah, for example, and his student, Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, championed the idea of giving discretionary powers to the ruler in order to add to the efficacy of Islamic law, and in order to be able to realize justice in instances where the actual dictates of the manuals of Islamic law seem to fall short. So to give you an example of what I'm talking about, Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah says that, this is rather disturbing, so just hold on to your seats, but it's his example, not mine. If a man mutilates his wife's genitals, we're not talking about circumcision here. But if a man mutilates his wife's genitals, then it becomes illegal for him to divorce her. And if he should divorce her, either because he wants to or because she wants to, then he remains financially responsible for her up until her death. Alright? Now this was clearly a violation of the letter of the law that you would find in any manual of Islamic law. Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, however, insisted that the ruler be given this kind of discretionary power in order to be able to effect justice in those instances whereby a literal application of the law would lead to injustice. In fact, he and his teacher, Ibn Taymiyyah, are explicit in stating that any place we find justice, that is to be considered an application of Islamic law. Now, my point here is not to argue, for the substance of these deductions on the part of these jurists. It's simply to question, however, the whole idea that any time that Muslims recognize a man-made law or a man-made injunction, they are somehow guilty of engaging in acts of shirk or violations of Muslim monotheism. Now, there are all kinds of other examples of this that we could point to. Muslims, and this is another problem that we find in works such as those of Sayyid Qutb and others, is the following. There's a fundamental difference because what we have to consider here is the time period in which we happen to exist. And we happen to be on the sort of tail end of a development in the Muslim world that sees a lot of Islamic thought come out of the post-colonial mode of thinking. That is to say, where Muslims were trying to sort of reposition themselves in such a way that they could reclaim rights and positions that they felt had been lost to them. All right? And part of that was to attack and to criticize the prevailing order. And what you'll find in all these works is a very virulent attack on Muslim rulers who refuse to apply Islamic law. And that in itself is fair enough. Just think about how we feel when the government threatens not to apply the Constitution. It's the same sort of sentiment. The problem, however, is that oftentimes these books are read with a sort of a false transferability in them. That is to say, that we assume that that which applies, or could theoretically be applied, to a Muslim polity that does not apply Islamic law, applies equally to a non-Muslim polity that does not apply Islamic law. In the same way that Muslims should oppose a Muslim polity that does not apply Islamic law, they should oppose a non-Muslim polity that does not apply Islamic law. This is very problematic. And this was never the opinion or the attitude of pre-modern jurists. Pre-modern jurists recognized non-Muslim polities as legitimate, and the laws of non-Muslim polities as legitimate. And to make a very long story short, this is very easily identified in the principle of what is called extraterritoriality. And without getting too technical here, extraterritoriality produced institutions and Islamic law that are standard features in the manuals of Islamic law that granted, for example, merchants from non-Muslim countries who were traveling in Islamic lands exemptions from Islamic law, all right, and allowed for them to have their cases tried according to the law of their own land. So if you were a Venetian merchant and you ended up in Cairo and you got into a dispute with a Genoan merchant, right? Islamic law would allow Italian law to adjudicate this dispute between the two of you as opposed to impose Islamic law. All right? I mean, this was the attitude. Clearly, understood that that is their law, that is a legitimate law, and we will simply act as bailiff in this particular incident. And the point that I'm making here, again, is the idea that a Muslim's attitude toward a Muslim state that flaunts or violates God's law is not transferable to a non-Muslim state that does not have Islamic law. In fact, I want to sort of backtrack in a sense and locate what is really at the heart of this sort of exaggerated opposition to everything that can be identified as man-made law. Because in the modern Muslim psyche, man-made law it has come to sort of constitute an anathema. When you hear that, there's a very sort of sharp, visceral reaction because it's understood to be not only a violation of, but a flaunting of God's law. Well, part of the reason for that is this. As I said, in pre-modern times, Muslims were quite comfortable with a modicum of discretionary powers in the hands of men. What happened is that when modern Muslim states came into being, the state assumed a monopoly over the law. And with that monopoly over the law, it sort of from a Muslim perspective, from the perspective of Muslim activists, it abused that legal authority in an effort to supplant Islamic law with laws of foreign origin. It's in that context that man-made gets equated with a disregard for, a contempt for God's law. In pre-modern times, man-made did not have that connotation. And this is part of what we must be very careful about when we're trying to talk about Islam. Because if we're not careful about the space in which we happen to be, we can equate man-made, for example, with contempt for Islamic law, even in a place like America, where that is, I hope, clearly a not the implication. All right? Now, this raises another very important issue, and there are only a few others that I want to get to, that I think is very important to understand. And that is this. We tend to think of Islamic law as purely a matter of Muslim interpretation of Islamic scripture. And therefore, what renders something Islamic is whether or not we can find some prescription or injunction that urges or requires of Muslims that they pursue a certain thing. In other words, if we want to know about the compatibility between Islam and democracy, for example, what we look for is, well, where does the Quran require Muslims to establish democracy? And if Muslims are sort of unable to show where the Quran dictates democracy, or where a spontaneous reading of the Quran would lead to support for democracy, then the attitude is that, you see, Islam doesn't really support democracy. And when Muslims say that, they're just telling you what you want to hear. All right? Now, what I want to what I want to try and convey to you is the following. From its inception, Islamic law has always included a reflex that said that in society, that is pre-Muslim society, there may be any number of ways of doing things, values and institutions that are perfectly fine. And what we as Muslim jurists will do is process these on the data of scripture, and anything that we find that is compatible with that is to say does not violate that, we will then re-inscribe with Islamicity. In other words, non-Muslim institutions can become Islamic ones by a simple act of inscribing them with Islamic legitimacy. And so, for example, if you take the symbol of Muslim society, society is, of course, I mean, the visual symbol is, of course, of the mosque. With you have your dome and your nice minaret. That does not come from the Quran. It does not come from the practice of the Prophet. They didn't have these kinds of things in Mecca or Medina where the Prophet was. Muslims simply found these in non-Muslim lands and reinscribed them with Islamicity. And they did this time and time again with any number of legal institutions. All right? And so what we're looking at is that Muslims may come to America and they may find things in society that the Quran did not put there, that the practice of the Prophet did not put there, but which can certainly be processed in a manner that they can be inscribed with Islamicity. They can become Islamic, not necessarily in the sense of being completely normative or representative of an ideal, but certainly acceptable from the point of view of one who wants to live a life that is that entails a serious commitment to religion. And so when we speak about Islamic law is not simply the dictates of the Quran and the Sunnah. And provenance, that is, place or time, has never been a source of Islamic law alone. And so when we talk about Islamic law in America, we should abandon this notion that what that entails is Muslims coming to America and simply superimposing. In other words, American society in and of itself, from the perspective of Islam, has no legitimacy. And a really, truly committed Muslim community will simply want to do what with the American order? Take the whole thing and what? Wipe it out and replace it with an Islamic order. All right? This is never the way Islamic law. Never the way Islamic law has operated. And this is, again, Islam in its most authoritative classical expression. And let me just give you one idea quickly. That sort of underscores this fact. If you go to the tables of contents in any manual of Islamic law, classical Islamic law, you'll find all kinds of chapters. All right? Chapters on surety, chapters on debt forgiveness, chapters on torts, liability, etc., etc. You'll find all of these chapters. The fact of the matter is that these chapters are not reflective of either the dictates of the Quran or of the Sunnah. What they are reflective of is reality that was found in the lands into which the Muslims came, all right, that produced dispute situations that the Muslims then institutionalized, and they became Islamic law. So many of these institutions come from non-Muslim lands and non-Muslim backgrounds. Some of them are accepted in toto, some of them only after a certain amount of modification or adjustment, all right? But this is the way typically that Islamic law grew. Not only that, this was at a time when Islam was a numerical minority in these lands. In his book, Conversion to Islam in the Medieval Period, Professor Dick Bullitt, Richard Bullitt from Columbia University, makes the point that the central lands of Islam did not become majority Muslims for centuries after the conquests. Right? For centuries, Muslims were a political majority, that is to say, they held power, but a numerical minority. The societies over which they assumed rule were majority non-Muslim. Alright? Now, think about the fact that all of the founders of the schools of Islamic law died during a period when Islam was a minority. They all died in the 3rd century of Islam, which, according to Professor Bullitt, was before Muslim society became predominantly Muslim. And so what we're seeing here is an ability on the part of Islam to interact with non-Muslim society in a manner that recognizes that there may be any number of aspects of that social order, political order, economic order, that are perfectly legitimate from the perspective of Islam, and that can be adopted and inscribed with a legitimacy in Islam. Now, let me move on to, very quickly, the issue of loyalty. And here, I've already alluded to the fact that we should not assume that whether or not Muslims are loyal to a polity like America is based solely on religion. And I think this is something that we need to pay a special attention to, because what it does, in a sense, is that it puts all of the onus on the Muslim community and assumes an ideal order. That is to say, it assumes that the American state is conducting itself in an ideal fashion, or that the American social order is an ideal social order. I want to give you a sort of hypothetical that hopefully will aid us in how we think about this. Think about the following. It's 10 p.m. It's 10 p.m. You are a black American male, mid-30s. You are driving on the back road of anywhere, USA. Your car breaks down. You do not have a cell phone. Therefore, you'll have to get out of your car and knock on somebody's door to get help. You get out of your car, you come upon a patch of houses. Half these houses have American flags hanging outside. The other half does not. Which of these houses do you not want? Now, the point that I'm being made here is, now, and whenever I've asked this question to predominantly black American audiences, or even audiences of color, as it were, overwhelmingly, the one without the flag. All right? And the point that I'm making is that, why is this not taken into consideration in terms of gauging whatever levels of alienation that Muslims may have from the host polity? In other words, why is religion the only ingredient that's ever pointed to as an explanation for why Muslims may feel a degree of alienation? All right? I think this is a point that, I mean, really calls out for some consideration. Now, two more points and then I'll stop. We'll open for questions. The other point is this, and this, I think, has a lot to do with a certain culture. And this is more so the case among immigrant Muslims, but there is an extent to which, sort of by osmosis or enculturation, even a number of indigenous Muslims have adopted this. And this is this. Classical or pre-modern Islamic law emerges out of what political theorists refer to as a weak state tradition. By weak state, I'm not talking about military power, all right? But I'm talking about states in which the state itself is not the focal point of people's primary identity. In other words, pre-modern states are sort of like yous. Over here, you have sort of the primary sense of loyalty to family, tribe, etc. On the other end, you have primary public loyalties to religion, sect, even maybe school of law. The state here is actually in the valley, and that's the lowest level of loyalty and sense of identity that people feel towards the outside, i.e. toward the state. Modern states are the opposite. They're the opposite, all right? You have, family here, maybe family religion, and group or a race here, and the maximum sort of sense of identity goes to the state. Right? That's sort of what makes us all Americans. All right? Now, but the point that I'm trying to make here is that in coming out of a weak state tradition, all right, Muslims are still in a transitionary stage where a weak state culture informs their sensibilities about the degree of loyalty to give to any state, not simply the American state, but to any state. All right? And I know that there are some here who say, well, wait a minute, that certainly can apply to the Muslim world, where Muslims seem to be very loyal to their states. Well, two things here. I would say, don't believe everything you see, first. And then secondly, Muslims identify with Muslim states primarily as repositories of cultural and ethnic identity. That is to say that to be an Egyptian or to be an Indian, for example, is a cultural historical identity that precedes the state and transcends the state. All right? The state is held to be a sort of repository of that identity. And it's on that basis that they identify with the state. If that state goes away, they still identify as Egyptians, as Indians, etc. It is part of their ethnic identity. And it's on that basis that they identify with the state. This is part of what you might want to call, you know, a certain gap. That's going to take a matter of time before Muslims can sort of emerge out of this weak state sort of mentality into a more strong state one. But here I have just two little questions. First, one of the issues, and by the way, not only religious Muslims, but religious Christians in America have raised this point. Professor Stephen Carter, for example, makes the point that one of the issues that religion faces in America is that our thinking in America tends to begin with the state and the interests of the state, and then to figure out sort of how religion can be brought into conformity with the interests of the state. All right? Now, if that's the case, I think it's fair to ask the question, why religiously committed Muslims, or Christians for that matter, or Jews for that matter, should not reserve their deepest religious commitments for something other than the state, given that the state is never going to prioritize a religion as a repository of values that inform and that provide a basis for life. The second issue that I want to raise is this. Let's suppose that Muslims emerge out of this weak state mentality and they arrive at a strong state political culture. That is to say that they identify with the state and they go look to the state to provide it with and to oversee a social political order that is in conformity with their vision of the good. What would happen if Muslims in America, for example, were to say, you know what, American state, we want to push for full prosecution for adultery and fornication? Would that be looked upon as simply being purely a matter of Muslims pursuing legitimate interests? And by the way, I mean, if you look at this from the perspective of the Black American community right now, for example, that's a community where some upwards of 65% of children are born out of wedlock. All right? Would that be recognized as a legitimate aim? Or would this sort of be looked at as some sort of stuffy fifth column attempt to sort of impose the dreaded Sharia on society? And so the point that I'm making here is that if Muslims are to come into a full identification with the American state, then there's some give and take that has to be made on both sides. All right? Let me end by saying the following. I think that we are in a point in our history where we are in desperate need of open, intelligent, honest, and courageous discussions, debates, and exchanges about the possibilities of America and the possibilities of Islam in America. It's my hope that we will not suffer from what the French intellectual Guy Debord refers to as the tyranny of the spectacle. The tyranny of the spectacle. And what he's referring to is the fact that we end up in a society in which the images that are produced about a particular group undermine our ability to actually encounter that group. In other words, I am talking to you face to face. I'm touching you. I'm exchanging with you. But rather than hear me, the image that is produced about me comes between you and me, so that you cannot hear me and you cannot trust me, and therefore we cannot get beyond where we are right now. Of course, this is going to take a lot of courage and a lot of digging deep. And I'm not making a political slogan here, but let me just end by saying, yes, we can.